Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Specializes in the use of mindfulness as a tool for self-exploration. His spiritual home is Spirit Rock Meditation Center, where he has students in the Dedicated Practitioners Program, a two-year course of study whose goal is to make daily life a spiritual practice. He's going to talk on the difficulties of loyalty to one's spiritual path can result in leaving, even abandoning family and loved ones. Tom.
Thank you. Well, it's great to be here. It's been a long time since I've been. Can you hear me, by the way? Am I okay? It's been a long time since I've been here, and it's an honor to be asked to speak. Especially happy, this is also the first time for my partner, Craig Wenzel, being at the Gay Buddhist Fellowship. So, feel great to be here. I guess the theme of what, I was thinking this morning on the way over, what's the theme of what I'm trying to say today? It would be something like that, the idea that being good or being nice in the conventional sense can often really be the near enemy of a genuinely authentic or even a spiritual life. Of all the stories of the Buddha, the one that has always interested me, intrigued me the most, is what happens, what he does right at the beginning of his spiritual journey. You probably know the story. You know, when he was born, his father consulted a seer who said that Sid would either become a great spiritual teacher or a great king. And the father, who was a king, wanted him to be a king, wanted him to follow in the family business. And he reasoned that, you know, people get into spiritual life because of great suffering in their life. So he saw to it that there was going to be no suffering in Sid's life. And there's all kinds of stories about, you know, there were in the palaces that he lived in, there were pools of different colored lotus flowers. And at night, servants would come in and remove the ones that were wilting so that the Buddha would never have to see anything dying. And they went to these great lengths to shelter him from suffering. And, of course, the whole thing backfires because in his late 20s, Siddhartha suddenly is confronted with the reality of dukkha, you know, the pervasive unsatisfactoriness of human life, the pain, lamentation, sorrow, and grief that all human beings must suffer regardless of their station in life. And so this happens to him. He has this realization of that he's kind of a fraud has been perpetrated on him, I guess. That this reality of suffering is in his face, and he's on fire with the desire and the drive to find out if there is some way out of this human fate. And what he does, you know, in response to this calling, is essentially he runs away from home. On the very night that his son Rahula is born, there's a touching story about how he looks in the chamber where his wife and his son are cradled and sleeping, and he says goodbye to them mentally, and then he runs out the back door, you know, of course, escorted by heavenly beings and so on, and goes off into the forest to become a renunciate. Now, you know, because this is the Buddha, you know, we sort of gloss over what this must have been like for the people around him. But imagine what his father might have thought, you know. You ingrate. After all I've done for you, you know, you don't even say goodbye. You know, he didn't leave a note. Nobody could read or write in that palace. He was selfish, you know. What about his wife? I'll never get to be queen. You know, or his son, you know, deadbeat dad, he might have been called. The son will, you know, never have a father. I mean, in retrospect, you know, now that he became the Buddha, you know, it looks different. But at the time, when he didn't know that he was going to find anything on his quest, this looks like pretty bad behavior, and especially in that part of the world where loyalty to family and clan is even, you know, much more important than in our part of the world. The Buddha's leaving home is, you know, the Buddha's life story is an archetype of the spiritual journey, the hero's journey or the wise man's journey. And it's by no means an uncommon story. Another example of something similar would be in the life of Ramana Maharshi. Do you know Ramana, the great Hindu, one of the great Hindu saints of the last century? Briefly, his story. He's a 16-year-old kid, an ordinary Hindu kid with no particular spiritual interests. And one day, the Buddha confronts suffering. He confronts death. He suddenly has a premonition, my God, I'm going to die. And there's nothing I can do about it. And he lies down on the floor to imagine, what is death like? What happens when I die? And had a spontaneous, deep spiritual awakening. He awakened in Hindu terms to the reality of eternity, to the self, to the Atman, which is Brahman in their language. And deep joy, deep bliss. All he wants to do now is become absorbed in the bliss of being, as he later put it. But he's in high school, and he's having to go to high school and take classes. And he doesn't want to be doing this anymore. He can't focus. He can't concentrate. So what does he do? He runs away too. In his case, he did leave a note saying, "Don't try to find me. You know, I'm going off in obedience to the call of my father." And he steals some money. He stole some money from his brother to get on the train to get out of Dodge. He gets on the train and he goes down to a little town at the foot of a holy mountain in southern India called Arunachala. He gets there with the remaining money. He doesn't send it back to his brother. He throws it in a pond in a temple. He gets rid of all his clothes except for a loincloth, and he just sits down and goes into this inner absorption. He doesn't speak again for 7 years. This is a 16-year-old kid. He sits there unprotected from the elements. He's fed when he's fed and not otherwise. Anyone who has any doubt about the reality of higher states of consciousness just has to only read the life of Ramana. It's so amazing. It's so inspiring. And he absorbs himself in this bliss. And after a few years, his fame is starting to spread, because while there are lots of renunciates in India, you usually don't become one at age 16. Usually you're much older and you've raised a family and so on, and then you do that. So he's 16, and apparently there was, there was an aura of bliss and peace around him, and so people are coming and visiting him, and he's now known as the Silent Sage of Arunachala. And word gets back to his mother that there's the Silent Sage, and she figures out that's probably my son. So she gets on the train, she goes down to visit him, to find him. She gets there, and she finds him sitting in front of a temple, and he's a wreck. He's emaciated. His hair is down to here. He's malnourished. He's not bathed. His fingernails, I've seen pictures, they're out to here. She's horrified. And she begs him, come home. Come home. You know, you can meditate at home. You know, you don't have to. This is a little extreme. You know, she cries, and all seriousness aside, she cries and entreats him day after day to come. And he was still in his 7 years of silence at this period. He would not speak. He sat there in front of her, you know, and silent. After a few days of these entreaties, he finally relents. He gets a pencil and paper, and he writes a note to her. Basically, I wish I had the exact words. Basically saying that when the ordainer of all dictates a fate for you, a destiny for you, and other people object, it is best just to remain silent. And he hands his note to his mother and gets up and walks away. And she goes home bereft and heartbroken, thinking he's lost his, he's off his rocker. I mean, you know, in this country, he would have been hospitalized and given drugs, and Prozac or something. Now, in both of these cases, there's a happy ending. You know, in the Buddha's case, Rahula, his son, and his wife became disciples in the Sangha. In the case of Ramana, his mother, eventually an ashram grew up around Ramana. And people came from all over the world to be taught. I mean, he was quite a remarkable teacher. And his mother came and cooked in the ashram and learned to see her son as kind of a divine being. And when she was sick, she said, "The only thing I want is to die in his arms." And it's quite a beautiful story. It always makes me cry. this the woman dying in his arms, staring into his eyes. So there's quite a beautiful, happy ending to this story. But it might not have been that way, you know. This bad behavior might not have been had a happy ending at all. Now, I get in terms of would you mind letting me know in about a half hour when a half hour of my talk's up? Otherwise, I'll never shut up. I'm a psychotherapist, and one of the things that I see in people's lives is a struggle with owning their own destiny, owning their or their deepest desires, or what individuation requires, whatever we call it. And that is usually opposed by family, conventional morality, guilt feelings, loyalties. And this is so this struggle that we see Ramana and Buddha, the Buddha going through, in more mundane ways, many of us, probably all of us to some degree, have to face. Just some more mundane examples, like a meth addict. I've talked to a lot of people trying to get off meth. You know how hard that is, if you've ever done it. I mean, it's hard. And one of the things that a lot of people who've been really immersed in addiction have to do when they get clean is abandon all the people that they know, because they were all using, and I can't stay sober if I'm in a relationship with you, even sometimes partners. And the anguish and guilt that people go through when they do this is often really excruciating, and some people don't make it. Some people say, "I can't do this." So there's a good example. In therapy too, there are very subtle kinds of unconscious loyalties that may sound very surprising if I talk about. I'll give a couple of examples. There are people who are depressed, for instance, who grew up in depressed families, where the emotional coin of the realm in their family was just being morose and miserable. And so my client, say, starts to get happy. He starts to be a little exuberant, a little hope in his life, and immediately feels guilty. Unconsciously, because to come from a family of depressed people and not be depressed feels like an abandonment of his family. They may be long dead, but there's some sense of betrayal of what right have I to be happy when they suffered and couldn't escape? What right have I to escape? It's a kind of survivor guilt, and it's very common. Another example might be an obese man, morbidly obese guy, in his late 40s. I'm kind of making these examples up because it's a small community I want to talk about. But these are very similar to things that I've really seen. His late 40s, everyone in his family is also fat, and they all tend to die in their mid-50s of heart disease. And he's beginning to develop problems, bone problems. He tells himself, "I'm a bear." And he's trying to be, being fat, and he's being a bear. But when in therapy, he has to admit, he likes the beer culture, but that's a rationalization. He doesn't like the way his body feels. He doesn't want to die in his mid-50s of heart disease. He wants to thrive. But his struggle is that when he starts to lose weight, there's this family loyalty. Nobody in his family escaped that fate. Why should he? If he hates his own body, what does that mean about what he thought about his mother's body, his father's, his brother's, his uncle's, his sister's, you know? To admit to himself that he doesn't want this seems not nice, and creates guilt. And so unconsciously he tends to sabotage himself when he's trying to lose weight. So in order to reach his goal, there is some sense in which he has to he has to be disloyal in a sense. One famous psychologist said that our pathologies are pathologies of loyalty, which is a fascinating phrase. Well, those are two examples of loyalty, of going off on your own. Another example that just seems really obvious to me is coming out of the closet as a gay person, as a gay or a lesbian. I realized I was gay when I was in my early teens, and I struggled with it for years and years and years. By the time I was 24, I was finally beginning to be ready to come out. Stonewall had happened. And I remember writing in my journal, life is asking me a very simple question. And the question is direct and simple. It's, do I or do I not have the courage to live the one and only life that is in me to live? I wasn't a Buddhist then, so one and only life I might strike now. And maybe not, I don't know. But the point was, do I have the courage to live the life that's in me to live? And I decided, yes, I do. So I met with Dad, my father. I sat him down, we had lunch together. I said, Dad, I've got some news, you know. And I told him I was gay. And immediately there was a look in his face of deep, deep pain and anguish. He didn't want a gay son. This wasn't his idea of the kind of man he wanted his son to be. And I would have had to have been made of stone not to have responded. And I felt some guilt, too. But, of course, I'd done some work on myself then. And I had some understanding that, first of all, I could identify with his suffering. I had some compassion for it because I'd been going through the same thing myself for years. But also some understanding that the suffering he was feeling was really due to his own resistance to reality, right? It's due to attachment. That is what all our suffering is about, right? Resistance to life as it actually is, to reality as it is. And that fundamentally, the only one who could really do anything about his suffering was himself. It had little, if anything, to do with how I live my life. Now that's an understanding that I was fortunate enough to have gotten by then because of a lot of good luck and a lot of help from other people. But you know, in my opinion, the majority of gay people on the planet never get to this point, even today. It's hard to believe in San Francisco, but I occasionally see people come in to see me to this day who could never look their father in the eye or their mother and see that look of pain. It's inconceivable. It's just not nice. It's not what a good person would do. I cannot disappoint other people in this way. I'm a recovering hippie. And back in the 60s in San Francisco, in every hippie pad, or many of them, you had to have this poster up called the Gestalt Prayer. The Gestalt Prayer is a quotation taken from one of Fritz Perl's books, The Father of Gestalt Therapy. And here's what the poster says. I am not in this world to live up to your expectations. And you are not in this world to live up to mine. I am I, and you are you. And if by chance we find each other, it's beautiful. And that's how the quote ends, and it's all decked out with little flowers, and it's very romantic and cute. That's the poster. The next sentence in the text that this poster is taken from is, and if we don't find each other, it can't be helped. That they cut that out because that makes it a little less romantic. It's not as sweet. But what I think Fritz Perls was saying something very, very important about the nature of life, you know, in all of that. That when I come into each of us come into this world in a particular situation, in a family. Many of us with parents who are trying to live through us, who have all kinds of ideas and expectations about what we're supposed to do. We come into a particular, you know, we're in a particular country. There are all kinds of expectations about what a patriotic member of your culture is supposed to do. Expectations after expectations. And we all imbibe these things. And at the same time, something is growing up in all of us. Some, you know, this inner world. And for people who are called to the spiritual path, it's a spiritual calling. But it may be lots of other things. Career, sexuality. And often these things conflict. And authenticity is a big issue. And I've always wondered why some people are able really like what was the grit in the Buddha that enabled him to do what he did, to take this huge risk of throwing away all the luxury in the world and going out in the woods? Or what was it about this 16-year-old boy Ramana that allowed him to just throw his everything away, you know, to give up everything and just immerse himself? I mean, what faith, you know? Just faith in Ramana's case in God, but faith in himself. Faith in that he could trust his own inner voice. I wish this was a more common faith. There's a poem I often... are you familiar with Mary Oliver's poems? Yeah, in Buddhist circles, she's mandatory, right? Everyone's read Wild Geese, my favorite one. This is a poem called The Journey by Mary Oliver. And I often give it to people who are involved in one of these struggles with finding their own path. Here it is. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles. Mend my life, each voice cried, but you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already light enough in a wild night and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. I love this poem. And when I read it to people or give it to people who are in one of these crossroad times in their life, I think it really speaks to them. It's interesting. It's the Buddha's story. It's Ramana's story. It's all our stories in certain ways. And especially if you're gay, I think many people can recognize this story. Did I have anything else? I think I'm out of stuff. a couple more things. One, a couple more thoughts. Families and clans and nations and peoples establish group identities very often through suffering, through shared suffering. We identify, we are with each other because we have a shared history of suffering. Like the depressed family, for example, or the obese family that I've told you about. That's how we know we belong with each other. I've imagined at times, what would it be like, what must it be like if, say, a young Palestinian boy, Ramana's age, or a young Israeli boy, has a sudden awakening of that depth. Suddenly there's this realization that all these identities are illusory, that the past is illusory. I'm not Palestinian, I'm not a Jew, I'm not even human on some fundamental level. All these identities are limitations. I have compassion for all beings because there is no us and them. We're all us. I have no enemies. I will not live on vengeance anymore. I can go on like this, but you can imagine somebody having this kind of realization in that part of the world. Or here, for that matter, in the war on terror and so on. Lots of places. So he begins to speak from this truth. What would people say? You know? How can you talk like this? Your brother and your father and your friends were killed by these others, these animals who don't think of us as human beings. You have to, our loyalty, we have to fight. We have to, you know, we have to stay together. Imagine the difficulty and what the wisdom of a Buddha that would be required to negotiate a situation like that. And yet, you know, the funny thing is that if people are to be free, you know, if there is to be real freedom in this world, something like that has to happen in these parts of the world, all over the world. And boy, do we resist it. We resist it in our personal lives, and we're afraid of it, and there are blocks of guilt to it, and so on. So it was just a little thought experiment. It's very interesting to me how loyalty through shared suffering is so much a part of our lives, and how often people feel guilty and conflicted about letting go of their suffering. How many people have heard the Mary Oliver poem, Wild Geese? You know that poem? Well, I'll read it. Not everyone's heard it. Because I'm done. And I brought this other poem, which I think, to me, also says something along... It speaks to the same issue and talks about her vision of spiritual life. Mary Oliver is a lesbian poet who lives with her partner in Provincetown, I believe. And this is her most well-known poem. It's called Wild Geese. You do not have to be good. Okay, that's enough. All right. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees and the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
So we have time for questions or comments.
Brent?
Thank you very much for sharing. One of the last things you said I found really interesting, but also raised some questions for me. The idea of shared suffering and loyalty and how that can give us a sense of communal loyalty. And that made me wonder about gay community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we identify as a community based on suffering, I know that I do. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's a good thing or not. So it kind of raised some questions in me about that. And then if the goal is to renounce suffering, then how does that kind of jive with life is suffering?
Oh, that's the question of the Buddha. That was the central question of the Buddha. Is there a way out of human suffering? And his answer to that was, yes, there is, and the answer is the Eightfold Path. Yeah, the whole question of the shared suffering in the gay community. I mean, certainly, you know, when we have this collective history of our oppression, the story of Matthew Shepard and these other, and going back centuries, you know, affected us all. I think personally we're better off if in our heart of hearts we can not identify as a victim. I think the identity of victim is probably is an identity which causes some really acute and intense suffering. Because a victim always requires a perpetrator. So we have to incarnate as separate selves, and somebody else has to be the bad guy. So it always has to be us and them, which already is a suffering. And of course, if somebody will say, well, there really are perpetrators and victims in this world. And yes, there are. I mean, it's not like none of this is real. I just, for me, the best example of how to go about this is the Dalai Lama. You know, nobody can deny that the Chinese really screwed Tibet, and he doesn't deny that. He's been fighting it his whole life, and he talks about the enemy, but he refers to the Chinese as our friends, the enemy Chinese. He refuses to let them out of his heart, no matter how appalled he is by what they do. And so there is no sense of us versus them. On the deepest level of all, there's a sense of our common and shared humanity. I think that's quite beautiful. I would love it if in our community we could have more of that. Well, I'd like it if everyone in the world could, if I could have more of that.
Once one decides to be disloyal in the sense that you want to make changes in your life, whether it be people you live with or your family or work situations, a lot of that desire to be disloyal is to really free yourself from suffering. And a lot of that suffering comes from essentially negativity, and one has anger because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, how can one... Is it okay to be disloyal and recognize what you need to do and go on that path that you need to go on to basically have better mental health? Is it also okay to be angry, or does one have to remain compassionate toward that?
Oh, this is such a good question. Thank you.
And that's something that I struggle with, and I don't know the answer.
Well, my feeling about that is when spiritual people a lot, they're trying not to be angry. Because, you know, that's what I would call being nice or being good.
Right.
You know, this sort of unctuous, I'm spiritual kind of, you know, I'm diaphanous and I float in the air and I eat, you know, a glass of water with lemon juice at night, and that's all the I take on my, I don't know, you know what I'm talking about. You have anger. Now, so that's reality. I don't think that that the teachings, as I understand them, do not have anger. At least, if that's what it is, I can't do it because I have lots of anger myself. The reality, the path is mindfulness of anger. Right? The path is to relate to my anger, rather than relate to the world from my anger, right? To know what it feels like in the body, to know what triggers it, what my conditioning is that triggers it, to study it. And that, to be able to do that, I have to go toward anger. I can't say, ooh, anger. You know, first of all, anger is suffering, isn't it? I mean, every experience of anger is unpleasant. So if I want to deal with my suffering, this is what I have to study. This is the curriculum here, is to learn to make friends with my anger, in a sense, rather than to treat it as the enemy. And also not to treat it as all bad, either. I think of emotions are information. If I'm angry, it's a signal from inside that something's wrong. My rights are being violated, or something is, or there's danger, something, you know. And so if I'm trying to escape from an abusive relationship, for instance, I need to be angry. First of all, I will be angry because that's just how I am. That's how we're constructed. That's how we've evolved. As a practitioner, as a Buddhist, I hope that the way I will deal with my anger is mindfully and with compassion, both for myself and for the other person. But the anger is there.
Thank you.
Hope that helps. Quinn?
Yeah, Tom, thanks for your talk. There's a couple things I just want to respond to that personally really struck some chords in me. First, about the cult of victimhood, I think it's a very important point to make. It's one theater around me too. I think as gay men, we have a lot of claim to being victims legitimately. I think we contribute in an outrageously fucked up way like this culture. And we're just beginning to like be treated in a different, more respectful way. But I do know how seductive that role can be. There's a lot of, we all love drama. I mean, we all love to like cast ourselves in dramatic roles. And there's something very seductive and enticing about being the victim. And you can put yourself in any number of different stories and movies and so on where you're playing this role. And it's a hard role to give up. It's just because you just get to star in this picture.
Yes.
Yes,
so well said.
Yeah. And so, I just want to acknowledge, and that's a point to give up the seductiveness of being this romanticized victim. And I just want to respond to one thing you said about anger, about how anger is suffering. I think the trap for me is that anger is exhilarating. There's something about the rush of anger. You get this adrenaline, and you get, and along with the role of victim is the role of the self-righteous person.
Oh, yes.
And that's another great role to play.
Yes.
That's high drama and so on. And with that, anger is there. It's fun to be angry because you're the self-righteous person. You're not like these assholes that are screwing up the environment or being George Bush and having this war and so on. So that's the trap for me for anger, is that it's very seductive. It's very exhilarating to feel that emotion.
Yeah.
And some, I acknowledge what you say, that it's an important emotion to feel. I don't want to like just own my anger, but I want to realize that it's just a step up to the evolution. I mean, I was at a point in my life where I didn't feel angry, where I felt I deserved being abused, so I was this person that deserved to be treated this way. The next step up was to say that that's false, and to feel the anger about being receiving that treatment. And for me, my work, the next step up is just get beyond that stuff.
Well, I agree with everything you said, and I thought your description of the victim and the self-righteous, there's real truth in it. It really said perfectly what I'm trying to say about victimhood. I wrote an article once called The Joy of Self-Righteousness, because I know this is exhilaration too. And what I was talking about, since I write for the gay press, I have sometimes been the recipient of angers that begin with, "I am outraged." You know, when the person who's writing the letter means, "I'm mildly annoyed by what you said." You know, and I must confess, I've written a few of those letters myself, because I have found an exhilaration in being righteous. And in the article, the theory I had, I don't know whether this is true or not, but we have been told we're disgusting, we're bad, we're wrong, you know. And most of us, many of us anyway, grew up feeling some of that. We took it in, you know. To turn it around and be the one who's right, I mean, is an exhilaration. I think to the extent that we've been shamed, to turn around and shame somebody else can feel in the moment really freeing. I felt that. And that's, for me, the source of the exhilaration. It's not I who am shameful and bad. It's you know. And there's a sense, an illusion, I would say, of freedom in that moment. And there is an exhilaration. I would say, though, when I study that more closely myself, the kind of mania in that, the manic high that you get from that, really is a form of suffering. It's a little more subtle. You know, but it's still this subject-object dualism. It's still right, good versus bad. It's still separation. It's still in the world of judgment, you know. To judge, I think, hurts the judger and the judgee. Right? I mean, it is a painful experience to be evicted from my own heart, and it's a painful experience to evict anyone else from my own heart, too. Well, even George Bush.
Well, I was about to say, you know, that's the ultimate touchstone. There's a point where isn't there a point where you have to judge, where you have to say, this is wrong?
Yes, of course.
I mean, that's a judgment.
This is wrong. The Dalai Lama, this invasion of Tibet was terrible. It's wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope people are people are standing up. You know, this war, what's going on is horrible. And, you know, we are all in this together. We are all us. We are all human beings. We are all suffering human beings. You know, I mean, I think we can do both. I think demonizing political leaders is really shooting ourselves in the foot, personally, politically. Because then that's what gets responded to. And it just becomes, you know, it's like Fox News, you know, watching. Oh, those liberals, you know. And then, the back and forth between the who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. And the real issues get lost in all that kind of drama. That's my personal view. Sir?
A teaching that's been really helpful to me that just that the Buddha taught about what you're saying right here is a distinguishing between the conventional level of reality and the ultimate level of reality. So on the conventional, which I'm not even sure I can really articulate the definition of those, but on the conventional level of reality, it is important to do something about situations, people who are causing harm in the world. On the ultimate level of reality, the non-dual level of reality, there isn't the separation, and you know, a deep state of equanimity is going to, you know, not that you won't act from that, but there's a deep acceptance of this is the way it is.
Yeah, I think probably many people in this room have experienced those different states of being. I have on meditation retreats of going into this exalted state where there's a sense of everything is beautiful, you know, of oneness with all. Everything is quite beautiful. Everything is perfect just as it is, you know. And then Suzuki Roshi, I think, was the one who said, reality is perfect just as it is, and it could use a few improvements. Yeah, that's the paradox that we live in. Yeah.
Back to the question about anger. Rachel Naomi Raymond, I think it's in Kitchen Table Wisdom, tells a story about the Buddhist and his roommate. And the roommate has an alcohol problem, and the Buddhist is trying to be very patient with his roommate, tolerating all kinds of disruptions and so forth. But not getting angry, of course, being very trying to be compassionate for this roommate. One night, the Buddhist wants to bring his new girlfriend back to the apartment, and he asks his roommate in advance, "Could you, you know, be back for the evening or something like that?" Well, as you would have guessed, the Buddhist and his girlfriend are there. The roommate comes in drunk, gets drunker, creates quite a scene. The girlfriend leaves, and he is outraged at the roommate, throws him in the shower, turns on cold water, yells all kinds of nasty stuff at him, and so forth. The next day, the roommate starts out in his recovery program.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you could never have engineered that. You know,
right, right.
I'll get him in recovery earlier by being, you know, nasty earlier. That doesn't work either. But how his outburst of anger was instrumental.
Yeah, it was an authentic outburst of anger, and it had a positive effect. Well, he was lucky, too. My experience with recovering alcoholics, that's generally not the way things are. But yeah, right.
Oh,
sir.
I'm just kind of, after listening to you, and this is my first time being here, I'm trying to distinguish between selfishness and the necessary disloyalty. Mm-hmm. In the circumstances I'm dealing with this, I have a relative that's suffering from Alzheimer's. And when she deals with me, there's a negative loop that keeps going around and around and around. Mm-hmm. And the negative, and my reaction to it is very bad. But this relative is older and doesn't have many people in her life. And so she needs company.
Mm-hmm.
And so where do my needs eclipse hers?
Yes, yes. I hope you're not expecting that I'll be able to answer it. Because I think...
You know, the question between disloyalty and selfishness.
That's the kind of real life issue that we face, where there's these dilemmas of my needs conflicting with yours, but I have an obligation to you, you're sick. I mean, this is really one of the more difficult ones to deal with. I think that that's why we have mindfulness practice, that's why that there is a mental discipline of meditation, of compassion, metta meditation, to make the mind quiet and to listen and hear what the truly ethical thing to do in this case is. I think nobody can tell anybody what to do in a situation like this. Somebody in your position might end the relationship, might back off altogether. Somebody might, as practice, might go become a nurse for this person or take care of. There are all kinds of different actions, and I don't think anyone can say, ahead of time what the right answer is. What I do think in general about this term selfishness is that most of us have been told that sometime we're selfish. I mean, one of the big secrets I see in people all the time, the secrets that clients have, is if people really knew me, they'd know how selfish I am, because they were told growing up, you're so selfish, all you think about is me, who has anyone not been told that? Really, it's pretty common. And so many of us have a very hard time learning to distinguish between selfishness and legitimate self-care. Was the Buddha being selfish when he ran off into the woods, or was this legitimate self-care? In retrospect, it was a pretty good thing to do. But at the time, what was it? There is a sphere of legitimate self-care. We do need to take care of ourselves. We are supposed to love ourselves. The Buddha said, you can search all the realms of existence. I'm paraphrasing, of course. And you will never find a being more worthy of your own loving kindness than you are. And loving kindness meditation always begins with oneself. Because until you first can wish yourself well and be compassionate toward yourself, until you can do that, you can never truly do it for another human being. So that's just in general, a general response, that there is a sphere of legitimate self-interest, or of legitimate self-care. And the fact that you're having these qualms about the relationship, I would say that that's a sign of the love you bear for yourself. And that whatever you ultimately decide to do, those feelings need to be respected and taken into account. And when you're talking to people about what to do, be careful to choose advisors who will also respect those feelings and not judge,
One last question.
I don't know who had their hand up, right?
No. Are you? Hi, thank you very much for coming, and I'm the great listener as well. My question is to you, is there a big separation or difference between suffering and joy in one's life?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
The difference, as in the intensities, I guess, emotionally, when one has a death in the family, or when one has someone being born, those two are in some way an extension of oneself for me. And I was wondering if in those cases, are they somehow related to suffering? In any case, are they both pretty much sort of in the same realm, this joy and sadness?
I guess I don't quite understand exactly. I mean, I experience joy and suffering as very different things. I like joy better. I'm sorry, that may have sounded a little... I experience them as very different. I mean, I find suffering... I don't like suffering. I have an aversion to it. I want to get away from it. in the terms of birth and death, these archetypal experiences in life, where there's a birth or there's a death, those are really interesting times in life. When someone is dying, you know, you may have had this experience when someone close to you dies, there's deep grief, and sometimes there's some great deep joy that comes up, deep sense of connection or of understanding of life. That's very hard to put into words. You know what I'm talking about? So often they're not that different either. You know, experiences of great pain are often experiences of great confrontation with life and a connection with others. So I don't know what more I can say.
Tom, will you stay around later for people who have further questions?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.